Some people follow the rules, I break them. I'm Soraya, and on Rule Breakers, we talk to the rebels who do things their way. Listen to Rule Breakers with Soraya on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
So that's President Trump talking about his big, beautiful spending bill. Robert Hogan joins us now, Professor, Department Chair of Political Science at LSU, to talk about it. How are you doing, Dr. Hogan?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm okay, sir. Let's talk about, I saw a CBS report last night where the reporter was directly quoting President Trump as saying, "Don't F with Medicare," telling the Republicans. But yet, Steve Scalise was on social media saying that Medicaid was for people, not for only people that were disabled, not able-bodied people that could work, et cetera. And I'm paraphrasing Steve Scalise there. I guess The question is, are they all on the same page here when what's in this big, beautiful bill? And I guess the question that precedes that is, does anybody really know what's in this big, beautiful bill?
Yeah, it's still a little unclear. It's my understanding the Rules Committee is still meeting right now. They met starting at 1 o'clock last night to hammer out the rules in the House. And what that means is it really sets the parameters of the debate, what is going to be in the bill ultimately, and whether it can be amended and that sort of thing. So they're still trying to decide what's going to be in the bill. Trump went to Capitol Hill yesterday. It's not certain whether or not he did any good, or he may have done some harm. He did make it clear, though, that he wanted Republicans online, that everybody needed to vote for it. It was a test of whether or not you were, I think at one point he said something like, if you're a real Republican, you're going to vote for this. It is something he is putting his political capital on. Mike Johnson's political life is on the line as well, whether or not he can deliver. It's a huge balancing act for Republicans. Remember, this is a piece of a reconciliation process. They only need to pass it with a majority, and that doesn't sound like very much given the fact that the Republicans hold a majority in the House of Representatives, but they can only stand to lose 3 votes. And it's a balancing act for Republicans. All the Democrats are going to vote against it in the House, and so they have to all be on board with it. But the balancing act, on one side, you've got a lot of the hardline members of the Freedom Caucus, conservatives, who want to use this opportunity that the Republicans control the federal government. They want to see real structural changes that make long-term changes into social programs. They want to cut these things even more. On the other side of the Republican caucus, you have a lot of the Republicans that are in swing districts in the blue states who are saying, look, you know, don't cut too much. If you cut too much into Medicaid, you're going to harm my chances of winning reelection. It's going to make it difficult for Republicans to retain control of the House of Representatives in the 2026 election. So Johnson is really he's got a major balancing act to play here. And if you will recall, when Biden was the president Democrats, you know, still had a lot of control in both chambers. Johnson was able to get things done in the House, but only because Democrats at the very last minute got a lot of concessions and then supported what he passed. He was never really able to pass anything of consequence budget-wise that didn't get the support of Democrats. So this is, you know, Mike Johnson's reputation here is on the line. This is the big game for him. If he can deliver on this, his capital goes up greatly. The price of his stock goes up greatly, and we'll have to see. And Republicans win. If they get it passed, they got to make certain that a majority of the Senate, the 53 members of the Republican coalition in the Senate, whether or not they agree with it. And if they do, it can be passed with a bare majority in the Senate. You don't have to worry about the filibuster because the process is working under reconciliation. So this could be, you know, the Republicans are on the verge of a considerable win with the president's priorities if they can pass it. But that's the question. Can they pass it? If they can't, then this is a huge win for the Democrats by being able to stop them.
I'm getting some texts from a lot of people here trying to, quote, help me out, saying you're confused. Medicare is different from Medicaid. whoever's texting this in, y'all, you need to go do some research, because the president was specifically talking about Medicaid, not
Absolutely.
Medicare. And the professor will tell you the difference when we come back. And he'll also explain why the president is concerned politically with Medicaid, not Medicare. So I know what I'm talking about, and the president knows what he's talking about as well. Y'all need to look it up to make sure you know what you're talking about. 620 traffic now, WWL. All right, 624, Tommy Tucker, WWL. To be clear, I said Medicaid because it stuck out with me last night that the president would say don't blink around with Medicaid, because that is a program that's run by the states but funded by the federal government. Explain the difference, if you will, Professor, between Medicare and Medicaid, and why the president would be concerned with Medicaid as it relates to elections, because you're talking about a different constituency. Am I not correct?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Medicare is a program that started in the mid-1960s that everyone who works pays money into, it is basically insurance for when you retire. When you get to a certain age and retire, then you receive benefits, and it is a health insurance program for people who are old. Medicaid is a program that is means-based. It's funded by the federal government and the state governments, and it's based upon your income levels. And it also, some of it goes to disabled people. Medicaid is what is on is being considered for cuts, because they're thinking about cutting whatever the bill happens to be. It's going to be a substantial amount, maybe $1.5 trillion over the next decade. And a lot of people are concerned about this because these are real cuts to people who are, for example, in nursing homes. About 60% or so of people in nursing homes nationwide are able to be in nursing homes because they receive Medicaid. In Louisiana, about 75% of people in nursing homes receive Medicaid based on their income. So this has the potential to have major cuts for that are real, and that can affect a lot of people. And that is why a lot of members of Congress are concerned about this, even ones that are in very red parts of the country. You think about very rural parts of the states like Louisiana. You've got a lot of people who are that rely on Medicaid, especially when they get old and they go into nursing homes. They don't want, the members of Congress don't want to fear, are fearful of the backlash that might have and how it could affect them electorally. So these are real big issues that we're confronting. Of course, there are a lot of people who argue that the Medicaid issue is something that we need to think about and talk about and maybe reconsider. And some members of Congress, some of the members of the Freedom Caucus, want very deep cuts and structural changes in those programs. So that's the balancing act that Mr. Johnson, Mike Johnson, Speaker Johnson is having to balance right now to keep his caucus together.
Representative Johnson from Louisiana, a lot of people, for example, in Julia Letlow's district, about a third of them in her district, she was elected by a wide margin, are enrolled mm-hmm. in Medicaid.
Absolutely.
So the Republicans are walking a fine line here, and I'm just wondering about Mike Johnson trying to wrangle his coalition. He's from a poor state, but maybe yep. the people that he's trying to wrangle are not from a poor state. So it goes back to all elections being local, and I just think this Medicaid part of it is a big thing, is it not?
Oh, absolutely. It's absolutely huge, and I think it's a lot of the success of this, I think, is going to come down to this issue. And why a lot of people are saying, and a lot of Democrats who are just standing by, watching to see what the Republicans are doing, are thinking to themselves, the Republicans are going to have a very hard time getting something like this passed. And if they do, the Democrats are going to pounce. You can see the commercials now going into 2026. Look, Republicans cut social programs, cut Medicaid by a certain amount, and you're seeing the consequences of it. The elections are always in the background of American politics, especially in the House of Representatives, where you have them every 2 years. And this is something that is certainly being weighed in the balance.
So the president gets this. He's trying to get the other Republicans to get this. That's up to Mike Johnson to get them to get this, or is that up to the president to get him to get this? Because ultimately, the president is not going to take blame for it.
Yeah, I mean, you could tell yesterday with what he said about Medicaid. You know, he does not want to get blamed for it. But, I mean, ultimately, it's his fellow partisans who are having to walk the line on this one. And it sounds to me like he's wanting to not so much give support or cover to them as he is trying to tell them, hey, you know what you need to do for me. Go out there and do it.
Because if he loses the House, he's got trouble for the next 2 years.
Exactly, and that has been the pattern, I might point out, in the last several decades in the United States, as you see, you know, a president getting elected and bringing the House of Representatives with him, even though the coattails have been really short in recent years. And he has the first 2 years to get done what he needs to get done, and then the House of Representatives changes to the other party, and it makes it, you know, exceedingly difficult then to get things done. So, I mean, the Republicans had difficulty getting things passed even when they have a majority, but it has been a bare majority. It would be even more difficult if they were in the minority.
It's amazing. Thank you, Professor. I appreciate your time. It's amazing some of the texts I'm getting, Trump defenders saying, you're obsessed with Medicaid. I'm not obsessed with anything. I'm telling you what your boy, President Trump, said. I'm just repeating what he said. So like it or not, don't blame me. I'm just telling you what President Trump himself told the Republicans, which is don't blank with Medicaid. So you can deal with that however you like. 6:30, we'll take a break. Come back. WWL. 6:43, 17 before 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL. Hot, humid today. Maybe a spritz on a windshield here or there. I had a couple of sprinkles on the way in. Legislative session continues. Libby Sonnier joins us now, Executive Director for Louisiana Policy Institute for Children. Talk about early education, where funding stands for that, etc. Good morning, Libby. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Thank you.
Let's talk about what happened, where it stands.
Some people follow the rules, I break them. I'm Soraya, and on Rule Breakers, we talk to the rebels who do things their way. Listen to Rule Breakers with Soraya on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Now, and then we'll talk about the importance of this, because one thing, and I said this earlier, that I continue to scratch my head over is, I talk to you a lot. We talk about the importance of early childhood education. We talk about reading at grade level. We talk about the state being poor. We talk about raising educational standards. But yet, inevitably, we talk about funding for this being cut, and I don't understand this at all. But tell me where we stand right now.
So where we stand right now is the governor and his executive budget had maintained the level of funding in his budget, about $78 million. Then the budget went through House Bill 1, which is the budget bill, went to House Appropriations, and we came out of House Appropriations with no cut. So we maintained the $78 million. And then last week, the budget went to the floor of the House and was passed with no cuts to early childhood education. So we're in a good spot right now. It's now, the budget is now walking over to the Senate. The Revenue Estimating Committee meets today, and it seems like they'll recognize some potential new revenue in the state, and then we'll see where the budget lands once they do that.
So let's talk about what this looks like when we talk about funding for childhood education. That's a nice phrase, but for people that don't understand, what does it mean?
Sure. So funding for early childhood education means creating access for families to be able to go to school and work and have some support, especially for our families that are below 200% the federal poverty level. And so when families have access to quality early childhood education, that means businesses have access to reliable workers that they know that can be there on time. And it's not just about families being able to go to school and work, which is ultimately incredibly important for our economy. But it's also really important because it allows our young children to be kindergarten ready. And if we've all seen the gains Louisiana has made in K-12 education. And Dr. Brumley was with us yesterday at the early ed day at the Capitol. And he said, you know, he basically couldn't imagine that, you know, children having access to quality early childhood education hasn't had a play into Louisiana's educational gains.
Does the Gator program have anything to do with this, the governor's Gator program, in terms of funding? Is early childhood education competing with that for funding, or is it two separate things?
I mean, I think fundamentally all education is a continuum, and if one group of education people get money, then you kind of have to jockey around. We don't see this competition actually because we want to make sure that children have access and families have access to the educational setting that they want, but it does limit the resources that we have in the state.
So, yes?
Yes.
Yeah, it seemed like a yes, Libby. It seemed like you were dancing around it, and I know you got the political things to take care of, and you the end goal is to get early childhood education funded, but I guess, and I don't mean to put you in a tough political spot here, but if you were to compare and contrast, if it's either or, I would think early childhood education takes precedent over the GATA program. I don't want to put you in that position, but it would seem to me that it does, because if you don't have kids, if you don't, let me rephrase the question, Your Honor. Let me phrase it this way. Talk about, if you will, Libby Sonnier, the importance of getting kids early and teaching them the fundamentals and then having them, say, reading by third grade level, when, for example, they might take advantage of the GATA program. Let me phrase it that way.
So fundamentally, we know that 90% of brain development happens by age five. And so all those good educational opportunities that really set children up to be successful in the K-12 space happen in early childhood. So you're learning phonemic and phonological awareness, which are sounds and speech of language so that you can be ready to read, learning how to get along with your friends, learning how to follow directions, having early literacy and math skills. All that happens prior to getting into kindergarten. And so we have, you know, approximately 70% of kindergartners are entering into kindergarten not quite ready to learn. Imagine if we had more access to quality early childhood education. We have over 100,000 children birth through age four that are in need that don't have access to quality early childhood education.
So as you say this, I'm thinking of the old example of, you know, whether you're learning math or reading or anything else, they always tell you, you got to have a foundation, right? You got to have if you're building a house, you got to have a firm foundation no matter what. Because if you build anything on a shaky foundation, then it's going to collapse.
Yes.
Is that exactly what we're
saying?
Right. And it's more expensive. Is that, and you have to deal with the offshoots of things collapsing and any damage to people or anything else
Absolutely.
In rebuilding. So is that exactly what we're talking about here when it comes to early childhood education, a proper foundation?
It really is. It is a proper foundation. And so we know that children that have access to quality early childhood education in these first 5 years of life tend not to need remedial education, need special education. They're more likely to graduate from high school. Once they graduate from high school, they're more likely to go towards post-secondary education. And then from longitudinal research, we know that children that receive that high-quality early childhood education in the first 5 years of life, they're doing better in their midlife. You know, they have better cardiometabolic outcomes as well as financial stability and health outcomes. Like, it is the foundation for all other foundations for learning and, quite frankly, for health, too.
So to be clear, and we're going to pick it up here when we come back, somebody texted in and said, you just said there were no cuts. There's no cuts as it came out of the House. It's still got to get through the Senate, correct?
Correct.
Okay. Just to be clear, everybody understands what's going on here. They hear what they want to hear and they think what they want to think. But as it stands now, there are no cuts. Originally, $9 million was cut. It was put back in the House. Now we got to see.
No, it was not.
It was not.
The $9 million was not put.
Well,
so we're hopeful. Go ahead.
Go ahead. You tell me.
Sorry. I was like, so we're hopeful with the Revenue Estimating Committee meeting today. If they recognize more revenue, that we're able to get the $9 million back that was reduced from last legislative session.
So it was reduced by $9 million. You're dependent on the Revenue Estimating Committee to say the money's going to be there to put it back. Accurate?
Accurate, okay. But let me be clear that the governor and the House maintained what's currently in this fiscal year's budget for next fiscal year's budget. So now what we're asking is if there's new revenue recognized, if we could get the $9 million back that we lost last year.
All right. We'll pick it up when we come back. And for those of you listening and texting in, I would suggest, and I'm not trying to be petty here or anything, but instead of trying to correct me, maybe you just listen to what we're talking about here and get the facts straight, and then you can text in. Just saying. 651-9 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 657 3 till 7. Tommy Tucker, WWO, back with our friend Libby Sonnier, Dr. Libby Sonnier, Executive Director of the Louisiana Policy Institute for Children, talking about the importance of early childhood education. Libby, earlier I was saying you wouldn't build a house with a bad foundation, so you could, you know, cut on the cheap out on a foundation so you could put an elaborate bathroom in because the whole thing's going to collapse, right? So I'm getting some texts from some people here of the get out of my yard ilk of the when I walked to school the snow was 10 feet deep ilk, that kind of thing. talking about that this is that the only reason this is necessary is because of negligence of parents. Talk about that if you will, please.
Oh wow, that's an interesting comment. You know what we know from
our
data,
I get a lot of interesting comments, Libby, believe me, I get a lot of interesting comments.
Well, I'm going to lean into the data and say that we know that 2/3 of Louisiana children have all available parents in the workforce. And so, and we know that parents have to work to be able to take care of their children. So it's not negligence. It's that parents need access to quality early childhood education where they know their children are learning and are safe so that they can be productive citizens and be part of our economy. We know that, you know, over 60% of our mamas go back to work within the first year of their child's life, because they have to. And so we need to make sure that wherever children are, that they're in quality, safe settings where they're learning and they're being cared for by credentialed people. And that's what happens when children have access to quality early childhood education.
Look, I know you can't speak to the people that escaped from Orleans Parish Prison, that you have no idea anything about these people. But looking to the stats and the facts, when it comes to, I find it hard to believe that you go from being an ideal student to being a murderer and escaping from a prison. So I got to believe that when it comes to societal investment, the best thing we can do is get people on the right educational track to keep them out of trouble. Do the stats bear that out?
The research does bear that out. We know for children that really do have this access to quality early childhood education, they have reduced rates of being in the juvenile system and the court system. And we also know that they have better health outcomes and they're finishing school and doing better in life. And so it is a strong, healthy foundation. Like you said earlier, if you have a faulty foundation, it's really so much more expensive when you don't do it right the first time. And what we're trying to do right now is that children only have one chance at a childhood. Let's make sure we're putting them on the right path to have educational outcomes so that they can thrive.
Libby, you convinced me. You know, you got an open forum here whenever you want. Come on back. We'd love to stay in touch with you and keep track of what's going on here. Libby Sonnier with the Louisiana Policy Institute for Children.
Podcasting isn't just evolving. It's having a full-blown identity crisis. I'm Allison Marino, host of What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined. A new series that pulls back the curtain on the forces shaping the medium now and what that means for all of us who love podcasts. I'm really excited to share the official trailer where you'll hear from some of the biggest names in the space. Ira Glass, Leo Laporte, Guy Raz, Hernan Lopez, Lex Friedman, AJ Feliciano, Dan Granger, and yeah, me too. Here it is now.
I still want to kill the word podcast.
That's not just a hot take. It's a symptom of an identity crisis.
Big company run media, and people are trusting it less and less. It's really important that we're independent.
There's a handful of companies that control the vast majority of podcast inventory that have the vast majority of the gigantic shows.
We left radio behind for a reason. We wanted to get away from all the gatekeepers.
I don't know that you could do this as effectively in video.
Podcasting is at a crossroads. I've watched the industry swing from hype to consolidation to reinvention. But this time it's different. From the producers of the documentary Age of Audio, Oxford Road presents the Media Roundtable special series. What's a podcast? The Revolution Redefined.
All of us who work in the media, like, yeah, we got to run a business and like, we got to make a living and we got to sell our ads and we got to do all that. But we all got into it because like, I think most of us, like, it just gave us a feeling.
A three-part series where you'll hear the leading industry voices give their takes on what podcasting has become and where it's headed next. Teaming up with Oxford Road and Age of Audio director Sean Colon for this series was fun, but also kind of a wake-up call. If you love this medium as much as I do, you've got to listen to What's a Podcast? The Revolution Redefined. It's out now, wherever you get your podcasts.